Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Truman Capote's best-selling book, In Cold Blood, has captivated worldwide audiences for over 50 years. It is a gripping story about the consequences of a trivial robbery gone terribly wrong in a remote village of western Kansas. But what if robbery was not the motive at all, but something more sinister? And why would the Kansas Bureau of Investigation press the Attorney General to launch a ruthless 4-year legal battle to prevent fresh details of the state's most famous crime from being made public so many years after the case had been solved? Based on stunning new details discovered in the personal journals and archives of former KBI Director Harold Nye, and corroborated by letters written by Richard Hickok, one of the killers on death row, "And Every Word Is True" meticulously lays out a vivid and startling new view of the investigation, one that will keep readers on the edge of their seats as they pick up where Capote left off. Even readers new to the story will find themselves drawn into a spellbinding forensic investigation that reads like a thriller, adding new perspectives to the classic tale of an iconic American crime. 60 years after news of the 1959 Clutter murders took the world stage, And Every Word Is True pulls back the curtain for a suspenseful encore to the true story of In Cold Blood. Book that we're featuring this evening is And Every Word Is True. Newfound evidence reveals Truman Capote's In Cold Blood is not the end of the story. With my special guest, author Gary McAvoy. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Gary McAvoy.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me. A pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much. The pleasure will be all mine and our audiences. This is an incredible case and incredible investigation that you've undertaken with this, And Every Word Is True. Now, as you write in this book is a result of over 6 years of research, which included... I'm going to ask you what that research included specifically, but this was dedicated to the career and memory of Harold R. Nye, Kansas Bureau of Investigation. Now, Truman Capote claimed that In Cold Blood is a completely factual account and every word is true. And your book includes a foreword by Ronald R. Nye. Now, tell us about... You say this book was based on stunning new details discovered in the personal journals and archives of former KBI director Harold Nye. Tell us a little bit about this foreword by Ronald R. Nye, about his father, and about these personal journals he discovered. Tell us about that first.
Sure, Dan. Well, Harold Nye was a a career law enforcement officer from his early 20s. In fact, he joined the KBI when he was around 23. And his entire life, through all his law enforcement positions, he had maintained reporter's notebooks, so those thin notebooks that slip in easily into your pocket. And right. He had some, hundreds of these that he'd collected over his career. And he kept them in banker's boxes up in the attic of his home. And Ron, who grew up under his roof, of course, always knew they were there, but was told never to open the boxes, never to look inside them. Well, when his dad passed in 2003, his mother decided to clean up all the stuff that her husband had been collecting, and he was a major collector, and had the boxes shredded, 14 of the boxes anyway, but there was one box left in Harold's office that she missed. That box ended up in the trash some days later, and when Ron came by to help his mother clean out the house, he looked in the trash and saw that saw two books that were that Truman Capote had given Harold and I some years ago. Both of them signed first editions. One was In Cold Blood. The other was Selected Writings by Capote. And another folder containing various documents, official case reports, and Harold's two of Harold's notebooks that he had compiled on the cluttered murder case.
Right. Now, with this discovery, he has these boxes. Ronald, being Harold's son, tell us a little bit about more about Harold, and especially for our audience that doesn't know, the role that we just spoke about briefly in the introduction, but who was Harold Nye to this clutter investigation, to the 1959 November murders? Who was Harold Nye to that? Before we talk about what Ron learned from looking through those journals and through that information, mm-hmm. what did he know at that time? And then tell us the circumstances that you were to be introduced to Ronald.
Sure. Yeah, Harold was one of four principal investigators, along with Alvin Dewey, Clarence Dunce, and Roy Church, who handled the Clutter murder case. There were about 18 investigators overall. And Harold was the lead field investigator, while Alvin Dewey was the case coordinator with an office at the sheriff's office in Garden City, where the crime took place. And Harold did all the interviews, the majority of interviews with townspeople, the families of each of the killers once they were identified, and traveled down to Mexico and across the country wherever he needed to be taken for these interviews. And let's see, what was the second part of your question?
Well, what was, as Ronald would discover, I mean, he knew he was, his father was a dedicated cop and real hard-nosed, and there was this room where these journals were, but what did he mm-hmm. find out about by cursory look at those journals? What kind of information did he find out?
Well, actually, Ron didn't actually look at the journals. He just knew that there was some value to them, and he was actually in a position with his ex-wife, who needed medical attention, and their medical expenses, which Ron opted to take care of, were mounting, and he needed to find some way of income. And he knew that these books by, and letters by Truman Capote had likely had some value to them, and so he turned to me, being referred to me by Christie's Auction House in New York. I had been a dealer of literary manuscripts and first edition books for some over 25 years now. And Ron approached me in 2012, believing that these letters and books had some value to them. And so we decided to mount a special auction for the materials, which included both the two books, two great letters that Truman had written, Harold Nye, and then a passel of other documents that Harold had collected in his casework. When the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, or the KBI, heard about the pending sale, they issued a cease and desist, which soon turned into a lawsuit, and that prevented the sale and publication of the materials. Ultimately, after a grueling 4 years in court, we ultimately won, and that's how the book came to be. But just in reading these materials, since I had to compile a through the discovery process in court, I had to compile everything that was in the Nye archives.
Right.
And as I began reading these materials, I realized that this was a much different story I was reading from the primary source documents than the story that, that Truman Capote had told in Cold Blood.
You write in a book that at that time, in your role, in your occupation, that you weren't a true crime fan at all, and that if the Kansas Bureau of Investigation hadn't launched this lawsuit preventing this auction, then you wouldn't have looked at these materials very carefully at all, because there would have been no reason the auction. Now, what was the reason? What was the reason? You talk about in the book in more detail, and very, very interesting and vivid, that Ron gets a call first from the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, and then you get a call from the same person. What is the premise? What's the reason why they want this information and their reasoning for this information to not be auctioned?
That was never really clear to either of us. Their claim was that these were confidential investigation documents that held confidential material, which was never disclosed, which never described, rather, and that there were privacy issues involved. But the actual reason why they were so obsessed about securing these was never made clear to either of us.
Now, with this, you say this is a legal battle here, but in this ensuing time, you take a look at this material very carefully, and hence, as you mentioned, this is the genesis of this book, but it doesn't come right away. Tell us about this whole discovery. You said you went back, and it had been since 1966 since you had read Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, so you started there. Mm-hmm. What are the other things that you looked at, read, and basically part of an investigation of sorts? What did you do in this research?
Oh, gosh. First I reread Capote's book In Cold Blood so that the material was fresh to me. Mm-hmm. Then I watched the 1967 film of the same name. There was also a Canadian production. I basically absorbed everything I could about the case, and that included Gerald Clark's fine biography called Capote, George Plimpton's book on Capote's friends and acquaintances and detractors, several other books of scholarship about Capote and In Cold Blood in particular, and basically became an expert on the Clutter murder case. And then I dug into the material itself, and that's where I started making rational comparisons as to what I was reading versus what I had read with these other materials. And distinctive differences came out that made it clear to me that that could be the reason why Kansas wanted this material so desperately.
You knew something was, we'll say, afoul here, but I wanted to know, just me personally, reading this, at that time when you looked at this, were you aware of the existing criticism of Capote and the book In True Crub in Cold Blood?
Oh, sure. Yeah, for years, many people had poked holes in Cold Blood, and in fact, first one to do it was Dr. Philip Tompkins from the University of Colorado, back in 1966, just a couple months after the book came out. And he actually made a 9-day trip to Kansas to verify many of the points that Capote had made, and discovered that some of the salient points were, let's say, less than accurate. But there's a long history of many people identifying issues with Capote's veracity. So it's
right.
not really
right.
a lot of news.
Mm-hmm. When you start looking at this material, again, the journals themselves, the notebooks themselves you write were especially important or interesting. Tell us about some of the very first discoveries that you made that you thought, when you took other information and all those sources that you had looked at, what was the first interesting, we'll say, blatant contradiction from In Cold Blood?
Well, there's one scene in Cold Blood, and the readers of the book and viewers of the film in particular will remember this, where Harold Nye is alone at the Hickok farm interviewing Hickok's father, Walter, and he spots the murder weapons, a shotgun and a knife, a Savage 12-gauge shotgun and a hunting knife. And while his hand is shaking, this is how the scene is described, he does nothing at the time. Capote reports this is happening 5 days before it actually happened. And at that point, Nye was accompanied by several other agents with a formal search warrant. It's a pretty important detail to have gotten wrong, but it certainly made for a dramatic scene in the book and the movie.
In this research, you also, Ronald talks about the relationship his father had with Capote and a couple of the events that he had witnessed himself. Tell us about Harold Nye's relationship with Capote.
Well, it was during a time where homosexuality was not as accepted as it was today, and Capote made no attempts to tone his effeminacy down. Not that he was expected to, but he was entering the heartland, a Midwestern town that had never seen anyone so splashy as he was. And Harold Nye, in particular, was not a fan of Capote's theatrics, let's say. So I think that was, he'd already prejudged him at that point. But Capote's job was also to get as much information as he could about an ongoing investigation. And Harold Nye held firm to the policies and protocols of investigative work and would not give him anything. That's not the case with Alvin Dewey, but that's for another time.
You will underestimate.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You really, what we've skipped over a little bit though, is that the incredible efforts that you again, this is very vivid, where you say Harold was suspicious and definitely not. He didn't like his theatrics and the flamboyance, but he also didn't like that he was always being pressed for details on the investigation. He knew that's mm-hmm. what was going on, but he took them out to nightclubs and he offered to take them to his famous black or be invited to his famous black white masked ball that was rubbed elbows with celebrities. And I think when you mention Alan Dewey, maybe we should talk about Alan Dewey, because the difference in In Cold Blood is Dewey's role in the book and Harold Nye's role in the book. And as you write, where Ronald is a witness to say that when Harold received a copy of In Cold Blood, what was his reaction?
He threw it across the room. He claims he read just about a third of it, and threw it across the room, calling it a fiction. He also, when he and his wife Joyce went to the film, see the film as honored guests, he walked out after 15 minutes saying it, we don't know what he said, but he was not happy with the treatment of the Clutters.
What was the relationship with the Clutters and Harold Nye?
They didn't know each other. The Clutters were members of, they lived in Garden City, and Harold and his family lived in Topeka, where the KBI headquarters was. So they did not know each other. Dewey was very close to the Clutters, Alvin Dewey. He was right. They were both part of the same Methodist church group, and both taught Sunday school. So they were very close.
Which leads me to my next question. Let's talk about Herb Clutter, because in this book and in this investigation and in your research, you find out that Herb Clutter, I mean, it's a very simple story that Truman Capote does portray in Cold Blood, that this innocent family is killed for less than $50. It's a senseless couple of psychopaths, and case closed. Tell us about Herbert Clutter and his importance in the community, and also some of the things that you found out about Herbert Clutter.
Well, up until his death in 1959, Herb Clutter was a very prominent farmer in western Kansas, indeed a pillar of his community. He was very successful at a time when many others were losing their farms due to a variety of economic factors. Clutter was also politically powerful, having been appointed by President Dwight Eisenhower to the Federal Farm Credit Board. He was also founder of the National and the Kansas Associations of Wheat Growers and various local organizations and the local farming co-op in Garden City, as well as a prominent leader in his Methodist church group. And a little bit more about the family. Clutter and his wife Bonnie had four children, two of whom still lived at home, both in their mid-teens. Mrs. Clutter had been suffering from severe postpartum depression for many years following the birth of their last child, Kenyon. And even up until her death, she was virtually bedridden, with her daughter Nancy and a housekeeper named Mrs. Helm taking care of most of the household duties while mother was frequently away at a psychiatric clinic in Wichita.
So Herbert was an upstanding citizen, but he was politically
very important,
especially in that you write that he was instrumental and important in writing policy or affecting policy. And you also talk about the time, and it's always has to be referenced in here, that we just come out of McCarthyism, and so socialism was not seen any kind of, social engineering, but any kind of intervention by government was not seen by everybody as benevolent or not agreed upon by everybody at that time.
Right. Yeah, Clutter was very policy oriented in setting farming. His approach to farming was to ensure wheat parity pricing for wheat farmers. And he had one major opponent in government, and that was the Secretary of Agriculture at the time, a man named Ezra Taft Benson. Benson was a virulent anti-socialist, and he viewed government pricing parity as a form of socialism that would not stand. So he had at least one prominent enemy in government.
Were there any instances that, from witnesses around that time in the investigation from Harold Nye, that would indicate any kind of animosity or enemies in his business dealings in the community of Garden City?
Oh, sure. Yeah. In Harold Nye's notebooks, he records many, at least a dozen episodes of threats against Herb Clutter for various infractions in his business dealings in the community, contracts broken, payments not made, promises not kept. So there were people who had literally threatened Herb Clutter and let it be known around town that there were threats. So as clean and squeaky clean as Capote may have made Herbert Clutter, he had his dark sides, at least in the business community.
You also write too, and not to, you know, to again say things that can't be backed up or substantiated, but you talk about the relationship, the friendship with Dewey and Mr. Clutter and the Clutters, and then the idea in the investigation by Harold that because of Mrs. Clutter's illness, they hadn't slept together for maybe a decade. So in the book, there is some speculation that there could have been a possible affair. Was there anything to that? And what I mentioned Dewey is that would he have wanted to protect his friend's reputation with working with Truman Capote?
To your first point, yes, that we do have evidence in the official reports that Mr. Clutter was very likely having an affair with the wife of his, the executor to the Clutter estate, a man named Kenneth Lyon, and his Kenneth Lyon was also the former business partner of Herb Clutter, and it was because of Mrs. Clutter's condition lasting so long. Many in the town, including the Clutter's own physician and psychiatrist, believed that Clutter and Mr. and Mrs. Clutter had not had intimate relations for at least 10 years. So Herb, in his early 40s, was a vibrant, powerful man, and it was known around town that he probably had his fun. In fact, that I found those exact words in Harper Lee's notes in the Truman Capote archives at the New York Public Library, that he had his fun on the side, and Bonnie probably knew it.
Right. Now, with this, too, when we talked about Alan Dewey and his role in this with Truman Capote, tell us what that role was in terms of the writing of this book.
Because Harold and I didn't, exacerbated by the fact that Harold and I didn't get along with Capote, Capote did find a compliant ally in Alvin Dewey and his wife Marie. And the three of them became quite close. Well, the four, if you include Harper Lee. And that friendship lasted for many, many years. And the Deweys, being so close with Capote, were the beneficiaries of his generosity, which many have looked at as a reward for Dewey having exposed much of the investigation details to Capote, which made the book so richly infused with detail.
You say that, talk about Dewey and his wife benefiting from the largesse, but we're talking about, you talk about the job that she got in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
Just the money at that time. The money at that time, you say, was the equivalent of $100,000 today, I guess. Tell us a little more about that.
Sure, yeah. Marie Dewey landed a plum role with Columbia Pictures during the production of the 1967 film In Cold Blood, simply as titled technical consultant, for which she was paid the equivalent of around $70,000 today. Capote sold that whole script for $15,000 at the time. So her reward was significant.
Right. Now, in reading through this, we also talk about a person named Mr. Roberts. We also talk about Floyd Wells. So let's talk about Floyd Wells and his relationship to Harold Nye,
mm-hmm.
and, of course, his relationship to the Hickok and the Clutter case, inevitably.
Sure. Floyd Wells was an inmate at the Kansas State Penitentiary. And for this round of incarceration, he was busted for stealing lawnmowers for a lawn cutting business he wanted to start. Now, when Perry Smith was paroled from the Kansas State Penitentiary, this was in, mid-1959, Wells was assigned to Dick Hickok's cell. Dick Hickok was in prison at the time for grand larceny. The two of them, Wells and Hickok, got to talking about Wells having worked for a rich farmer in western Kansas some 10 years earlier, a man by the name of Herb Clutter. And he told Hickok that Clutter had a safe containing $10,000 at most of the time, often more at harvest time. Attracted to that kind of score, Hickok made plans to rob the Clutters when he got out of prison about a month later. And he told Wells he would cut him in for a share of the score. But ultimately, as we know, there was no safe. There was no $10,000. And when Smith and Hickok hit the Clutter house on November 15th, 1959, they murdered the entire family after finding less than $15. $50. Now, Hickok claimed that Floyd Wells had given him a diagram of the Clutter home, showing all the rooms and where each family member slept. But the fact is, and by, this is by Wells's own admission in court and other official documents, Wells had never even been in the new house. The Clutters were still building when he left their employment in 1949. Now, when he first informed the KBI that he knew who killed the Clutters, Wells was soon interviewed by a KBI agent named Wayne Owens. And in that interview, Owens pushed really hard on Wells about the safe. But Wells described it in such rich detail, the agent was convinced there was a safe. Yet, Wells later lied in court about it, claiming he'd never given Hickok any maps or diagrams, nor did he even tell him about a safe. Now, obviously, the KBI knew he was committing perjury, yet they allowed Wells' testimony to stand.
Now, interestingly, too, is that the map outlined where these people were in this, what was described as a new house, that Wells wouldn't even have knew about the new house, but didn't know any details and couldn't have possibly made a map.
Correct.
What were you to make of that? And then let's talk about this Mr. Roberts and what you found out about supposedly this Mr. Roberts.
Sure. Yeah, the within mere hours after the murders, the night marshal in Cimarron, which is the famed cowboy town just 25 miles southeast of the scene of the crime in Holcomb, that night marshal reported three suspicious men entering the Western Cafe at around 3 a.m. And though it wasn't realized at the time, because the Clutter bodies had yet to be discovered, descriptions of two of the men bore uncanny resemblances to Smith and Hickok. And the presence of a third man there is the real mystery, since Hickok, in letters he'd sent to a reporter while he was on death row, revealed that the killers were to meet someone by the name of Roberts, just that's all we know, Roberts, after the murders. And at that point, Hickok was supposed to collect $5,000, which was apparently a second payment against a deposit he had already spent. We don't know who Roberts is. I spent years trying to track that name down. And the only place I found him, the name, was in two motel registers, guest registers, both in Garden City, and both the name of D. Roberts was listed as a guest, again, in two separate motels, and they both checked out the day before the murders, which I just find remarkably suspicious.
Yes, absolutely. Now, we also want to talk about, Alvin Dewey and the secret tapes of Hickok and Smith talking. Tell us more about that.
Wouldn't I love to hear those? The during the our discovery, during our trial, our litigation rather, My attorney, we had two attorneys, one here in Seattle and one in Kansas. And our Kansas attorney met with the KBI in the bowels of their building in order to pursue discovery on our behalf. And he found an audio tape in their clutter files that was apparently a recording of Richard Hickok and Perry Smith taken without their knowledge. Now, as far as I know, nobody knows what's on that tape, at least nobody here. I certainly don't. And it's something that I was going to certainly ask for in our discovery requests. But that's at that point, the state decided, knowing that we could have anything we asked for, decided to drop the second half of the lawsuit. And that kind of scotched our plan to get a hold of that tape. So it's still there, and I'd love to have them release that.
Part of this, too, is that you did the diligent, good work of good, really good journalism, and you have to get things corroborated. You can't have an idea, but it's not corroborated, as you,
right.
I think you quote, like exceptional ideas or notions have to have exceptional evidence of those notions or assertions. So
correct.
I'm misquoting.
Carl Sagan's advice.
Yes. Let's talk about in that corroborating certain facts in this case, you had the privilege of being able to understand or look at information from a person named Starling MacNations and his deal with Dick Hickok while he was on death row.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this fascinating deal and its results.
Yeah. A man with a memorable name of Starling MacNations was a reporter for the Wichita Eagle. And he met Hickok while he was on death row interviewing other inmates for a piece he was doing on for the Wichita Eagle. When he met Hickok, the two of them ultimately decided to collaborate on a book about Hickok's side of the story, a book that would be titled High Road to Hell, and a book that was never published. No publisher wanted to publish it since Random House already had Capote's In Cold Blood under contract. For the next year and a half, Hickok and Nations exchanged correspondence, with Hickok providing some 200 handwritten pages of effusively detailed stories about the crimes and the killer's cross-country road trip and Mexican journey and pretty detailed correspondence, all of which, the majority of which has been corroborated by the official investigation reports. But there's a lot of added material in there too, which is really what when I read those and compared them to Harold Nye's notebooks and finding some basis for corroboration, that's what really launched the concept for this book.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also write, again, fascinating, and I hate to beat up on Truman Capote, but this is a part of the official story, and this is a part of taking apart the myth and also looking at some really hard facts that the Kansas Bureau of Investigation had good reason to want this information not to come out. And that was the nagging question for you. Why would they go to such extraordinary levels, lengths, this effort to be able to suppress this information? And that spurned you on, certainly. Now, we also talk about how Truman Capote was able to get the kinds of interviews and correspondence and all of the information he got and these interviews with Dick Hickok and Perry Smith, despite, you just mentioned about MacNations, tell us about the rules that had changed and what Truman had to do to overcome those rules about this kind of thing.
Are the rules about what now?
Well, we're talking about just before Truman would attempt to be able to interview these inmates, there was rules up at that penitentiary that prevented that.
Right, I've got it now. Yeah, the director of prisons Colonel Guy Rexrode had a policy in force that, well, it actually began with Hickok and Smith in their incarceration. So many, they were the brass ring of front page sensationalism, and every journalist wanted to get an interview with Hickok and Smith.
Right.
The demands became so overwhelming that Colonel Rexrode, the director of prisons, invoked a policy that nobody could see the prisoners, and at this point they were scheduled for execution, which was put off for some time with various appeals. But as it turns out, Capote's law firm in Garden City was very powerfully connected, and they managed to get Colonel Rexrode to waive the policy of no visits for Capote, which upset Starling MacNations to no end, since he also had a horse in the race. But Capote apparently paid $10,000 to one of the politicians in order to get that kind of access.
As you write in the book, what kind of, there is, everybody's seen the movie, but what did that incredible access entail?
Well, that Capote could go into the prison and sit with Hickok and Smith for as long as he wanted, which he did. He apparently had. Now he claims, I don't have any basis for this other than his own words, that he claimed he had hundreds of visits with them, which just seems shocking, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you take the information and you're corroborating this information about this meeting, and you do, as you include in the book, you do put together other information that corroborates that there was certainly enough time for there to be a meeting. When you talk about that the two people were described, Smith and Hickok, we're talking about a noticeable scar on his face. Another person, they said they looked like they had something wrong with their leg. Certainly Perry Smith had a motorcycle accident. So these kinds of descriptions are not just a vague descriptions. They're very, very specific and compelling, basically.
Not at all.
So
right.
tell us more of the compelling information that came to you through your research to support the idea that this was not what Truman Capote had said, the simple robbery gone awry, but something more akin to a coordinated assassination.
This is really my hypothesis that there are probably one of two reasons Herbert Clutter was targeted to die, and that was either his local and or national political affiliations, where he was already known to be going up against the government, at least government policy. And secondly, this relationship he is believed to have had with his executor's wife. These form, I think, two substantial reasons that someone might want to bump him off. Does that answer the question, Dan?
I think so, but you also include that you look at information just previous to Herbert Clutter's and his family's murder, and you talk about life insurance, and you talk about a smoking habit from a guy that would have never considered smoking.
Oh, right.
Tell us a little bit more about that information and how that sort of supports your theory.
Sure. Herb Clutter was a strict disciplinarian, and as a Methodist, he didn't allow anyone who worked for him to smoke or drink. And yet in the final weeks of his life, he was known to be smoking cigarettes. His daughter Nancy would find him. And he was his whole attitude was anxious as surly in those in his final days. And on the actual day of his demise, he had purchased a long-planned life insurance policy, which paid out double indemnity if they were murdered. And not less than 10 hours after he signed the document, they were murdered.
Now, with the Truman Capote version and then the KBI attempting to stop publication of this book or this information coming out, again, you have a theory that there's a reason for that. And you talk about the official in cold blood. There's at the headquarters in Topeka, the KBI headquarters, there's a big display with all of the paraphernalia, the ropes, guns, boots, all the things were discovered. And then prominently, there's a copy of In Cold Blood. So tell us what your theory is in terms of, again, why you think that the KBI wants to preserve the story that is contained in Cold Blood.
The Clutter case was the standard of excellence for the KBI. They hang their hat on it as the case that makes the KBI. And in the KBI headquarters in Topeka, Kansas, there's a display, a glass enclosed display that features the actual murder weapons, the hunting knife, the Savage 12-gauge pump-action shotgun, various photos of the Clutter farm, and prominently above the Savage shotgun, a copy of In Cold Blood. The state's coming after us as hard as it did on the basis of protecting the surviving family's privacy. Just seems disingenuous when they're the ones promoting, one, the false story of the investigation for so long as they have, over 50 years now, and putting on display the actual murders of execution, of the weapons of execution.
Right. Your fight for the truth here, it didn't end with the court case. Let's talk about the resolution of the court case. Obviously, this book is out, but tell us how that came to be. What was the validation in court? What was your vindication, I should say? Tell us about that, about the court decision, what they said.
Well, our litigation had two prongs to it. The first was, were we able to publish the materials? And the second was, who owns the materials? The court ruled in November of 2014 that the court's prior restraint was incorrect, that the court should not have allowed the lawsuit to occur in the first place. Now,
right.
There, as many people know, in Florida, while Perry Smith and Dick Hickok were on the lam, they went through Florida, and during the time they were there, in about Tallahassee, there was a family called the Walkers who were murdered in a very similar style to the Clutters. And to this day, Florida authorities still believe that the case is connected and that Hickok and Smith are the prime subject, suspects. What happened in our case is that Florida, during the time we were being sued, Florida asked Kansas to exhume the bodies of Hickok and Smith for DNA testing. So the state of Kansas refused to honor our discovery requests and put off anything to dealing with our case for a year while they quote unquote reopened the case due to the exhumation process. Well, our court in its final ruling said that the state's position that a Florida investigation somehow reopens the file was unpersuasive, that at best information provided to Florida authorities cannot reopen a case when the killers have been captured, tried, convicted, and executed. So by affirming our First Amendment rights to publish, the court handed us a major victory in the main battle. And that just left the second prong, which was, who owns the material? The state claimed that because Herbert Clutter was a state employee, that his notebooks were state property. As we were going through that second prong of the case, of the litigation, that's when the state dropped its lawsuit because they knew that we would be able to ask for anything at that point.
Right, right. In The Pursuit of Truth, February 2015, you write that you tried to obtain the original 1960 transcript, and you went to Finney County. Tell us what their response was and a little bit about this search for this transcript.
Well, as your listeners might imagine, public documents are just that, public. You can go into any courthouse in the land and ask for the transcript of most any trial, unless it's been put under seal, say by a grand jury. In the Clutter case, it's Kansas's most prominent case, and yet when we tried this over months and then years, tried to get the original transcript of the Hickok Smith murder trial from March 1960, and it was simply unavailable. They said that if you want it, you have to call the main judge, the chief judge himself, and I couldn't get through to the judge personally, which I thought was an odd, I mean, why call the chief judge? This should be something the clerk handles. So I put it in a back burner until sometime later. We tried again some months later. They said, we don't have a transcript in our archives, but you have to call this law firm in Garden City and they'll help you. The law firm said that one of their stenographers was a collector of such things, and she's now retired in Arizona, and we could get her, they gave us her, how to contact her, and we couldn't reach her for months. It was just a Keystone Cops comedy,
right,
trying to track that down. We never did get it, though we ultimately reached one of her relatives, this person's relatives, who says, sure, you can buy a copy from us for $600. So it had become a commercial commodity at that point.
And you didn't want to purchase it?
I didn't need to. My research was done by that point.
Mm-hmm.
I'd worked around it. There were many, in the appellate court's cases, there were very clean summaries of the original trial.
Right.
And all appellate courses do have those summaries, so I was able to reconstruct the original trial through those. I just found it odd that we couldn't get that original transcript.
You talk about, too, that how fascinating it was to be able to read Dick Hickok's letters to Mac Nations and the kind of information and just the kind of, I'll have to leave it for the reader to read some of the quotes from what Dick Hickok said about the murders and life in general. Could you share just a little bit of that with our audience?
Well, Hickok was had what's called an eidetic memory, which is as close to photographic memory as one can get. He remembered specific details. Everything he said in interrogation had blown away the minds of the investigators and Truman Capote and Harper Lee when they were speaking with him. But the letters he had written were extremely effusive in their descriptions of the crime, the Clutter's murders, of their trips across the country, of their sojourns down through Mexico. And the 200 some pages, all in beautiful handwriting, true Palmer method cursive.
Yeah. But in that as well, it's supportive and corroborative evidence to your theory that this was not what Truman Capote and the KBI and those movies portrayed? Was it?
Let me read one portion of what Hickok had written here that might help.
Right.
I gently pushed the door open and entered the house. It was dark. The only light visible was coming in around the blinds at the windows. I turned the light on in the kitchen, and the sudden beam of light was frightening. I shut it off. It was really dark then. We moved forward as quickly as possible, but no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't stop the floor from squeaking. They hear it, I thought. I know they do. I've got to hurry. I don't know why. It is hard to explain, but I felt a measure of mixed emotions. I felt excitement, a thrill. I was going to kill a person, maybe more than one. Could I do it? Maybe I'll back out. What if they're not home? I hope they're not. But I can't back out. I've taken the money. I've spent some of it. Besides, I thought, I know too much. What would my partner think if I backed out? I mean, who's going to write that when they're already on death row? He has nothing to lose at this point and no reason, nothing to gain by making up lies.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly.
I was going to kill a person. So one person was for sure.
You cite in the book another reporter interview about other murders potentially. Tell us about that as you write.
Which reporter interview?
There was an interview later that you include at the end of the book where you talk about that there was a couple other murders planned. There was the killers had written or said in that interview.
Right. This was Capote's interview with the Hickok and Smith, that they were supposedly had two other murders planned. One with the banker in a small town, and the other I can't recall at the moment. But the banker, I always wonder if that the one they were talking about would be Kenneth Lyon, because he was a banker in a somewhat small town at the time.
Yes, and then again, for those
if that was, it would nicely tie things together.
Yes, with the affair with his wife. Yes, certainly.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Now, with us as well, you talk about the KBI wanting to keep this official version of this. Again, why do you think it's so important to them to be able to maintain this story?
Well, it would dim the shine on their star. That imagine that going on 60 years now, this has been the shining example of the KBI's dramatic crime solving abilities. And it really was great detective work at the time. I don't take that away from them at all. Thanks in large part due to Harold Nye, who just a few short months afterwards was promoted to assistant director of the KBI as a consequence of this work with the Clutter case. But I find it hard to believe that people alive to this day are still carrying some kind of call it a conspiracy theory that would want us not to publish anything from that era. I have no idea why they fought so hard as they did. It's completely mystifying to me.
Mm-hmm. This book has been dedicated to Harold Nye, and we didn't go into just his character and really his character in this investigation. When you talked about he was appointed director shortly after, his adherence at law, though, you write, that didn't make him any friends. So he was out of there pretty quickly, but his work as the investigator in this, and there's so much stuff that we didn't go into in this book, like one of the investigators working with Nye, just handed his stuff to Alan Dewey, who Alan Dewey then handed it to Truman Capote.
Right,
so we talk about
Truman
how that
Capote,
worked.
Right.
But we also didn't mention Floyd Wells's sentence was, he was looking at 5 to 10, and he was soon after released. And so there was a whole,
right.
Again, as you, this detailed book, you talk about the fate of Floyd Wells after all of this as well.
The governor at the time, William Avery, would not, rather, at this point it was Docking, Governor Docking, would not commute Floyd Wells's sentence. But we believe that there had to be some kind of pro bono, rather quid pro quo, excuse my Latin, some quid pro quo for the testimony that Floyd Wells had provided on behalf of the KBI. He had a 5 to 10 year sentence, of which he had served only a year or so. And at the earliest, he wouldn't have gotten out for at least 3 years served. But the way around that they found was to move him from Kansas State Penitentiary to the Kansas State Industrial Reformatory, whose parole terms were much more lenient, where you could be out in 10 months, including time served, which Floyd Wells had already done in KSP. So that was a sweetheart deal he got, in addition to a $1,000 reward from the Hutchinson News for breaking the case.
Yeah.
As you say, there's so much in, not just in this book, but there's just so much to this whole investigation and to my research that it's rather mind-blowing how many facets there are, how many avenues you can go down and keep walking for a long time.
Mm-hmm. What I found fascinating and absolutely the most vivid, I think, and crucial scene in the book is that the idea that the mother was, you know, Ronald's mother was, after her husband died, she knew all this stuff was in the attic, and she said all his stuff was there, 50 years of stuff, and she wanted it out of there because she was a little apprehensive, it seemed. So she wanted that stuff out of there, and just fortuitously, there was that box, and Ronald came over, and there it was, and he rescued it. And then all of these things that have happened, but the reason Harold kept all those details and documents that an investigator should have kept, and then he kept it all those years in case anything ever happened. He hung on to this case. It really bothered him. He never believed that this was the scenario, that they were murdered the way Truman Capote depicted, and that's why he was very angry, and he kept all those notes. And then Ronald needed to sell them, so again, fate intervened, I think, and got the hard-working, dedicated cop that Harold R. Nye was to be able to have this fine work that disputes the official, again, the official story that maybe shouldn't be official. It is very interesting how fate intervened every step of the way, and today we have this book and every word is true. Very interesting, I think.
It is. Yes, it is. Yeah, Harold wanted to write his own book, Dan, for some years, and he wanted Ron to help him, but he just couldn't. Ron just couldn't get to it. Pity.
Yes. Well, yeah. Well, I think it's been achieved. I think, like I say, it's a circuitous route, but here we are, and this incredible book, And Every Word Is True. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about And Every Word Is True. Newfound evidence reveals Truman Capote's In Cold Blood is not the end of the story. Gary, for those of people who might want to find out a little bit more about this, do you have a Facebook page, a website? Tell us how they might
take a look at
more information.
Thanks. Thanks, Dan. Yes, it's my website is GaryMcAvoy.com. And I'm on Facebook called In Cold Truth.
Ah, great name. Again, thank you very much. Brilliant book, And Every Word Is True. I want to thank you very much. You have a great evening. Thank you, Gary McAvoy. Good night.
Thank you, Dan. Pleasure to be here. Good night.
Good night.